Governor Stevens, thank you very much. We've got some time for some questions. There's a wide variety of people from different backgrounds in the audience, so I'd encourage you to speak up. If you can just say your name and the organisation you're representing, it would be great. There are some microphones around the room.
Hi, Jack Frankie, Point State Capital. Quick question on the jobs. How do you weigh a mining job versus a normal job in the economy? It seems to me that the mining jobs were very well compensated, maybe $150,000 or $100,000 a job, and a normal job in Australia is probably $40,000. I don't know the exact figure, but let's call it $40,000. How do you weigh a job loss in the mining sector, resource sector, versus the regular economy?
It's more like 60 than 40 for the average, but the point is a good point that many of the mining jobs are very well remunerated. You've picked a couple there, I think, that were probably near the top. But this is part of the adjustment we're making. There's less income, and the transition we're making is that the growth now has to come from other parts of the economy where average compensation is lower and probably average productivity is also lower to go with it. But that's just part of the cyclical adjustment that we have to make. And there's no point kind of complaining that the jobs we're creating now are paid less. That may be true, but they're the jobs that we need to create.
Thank you very much, Governor Stevens, for the very interesting speech. I'm Julian Callow from Element Capital. And I would be interested if you could just talk a little bit further about how you see the role of the exchange rate in facilitating the rebalancing of the economy. I noticed in your speech you're saying, and you said that the Australian dollar's declined and will likely fall yet further over time. But in terms of what you would actually like to see happen in order to facilitate adjustment, it would be very interesting to hear any further thoughts you have. Thank you.
Well, it's hazardous to predict exchange rates, really, but I think the big picture is the exchange rate has always played a role to help the economy adjust to terms of trade shocks. That's been the case for a very long time. It still is. It's playing that role. And we need it to play that role. If it doesn't, then the adjustment for the economy is much more difficult. And that's true in both directions. In the days when we had terms of trade shocks and the exchange rate couldn't adjust, it was much more disruptive for the rest of the economy. So, as I say, it's playing that role. I think it will continue to do so. The situation's complicated because of the way global interest rates are configured. That's true. There's nothing we can do about that. Nonetheless, I suspect that, as I said today, I suspect further adjustment lies ahead, conditional on one's view, of course, of how the terms of trade will unfold.
Hi, Kerry Morimoto from Duquesne Family Office. I was wondering, how concerned are you in regards to the already pre-existing high levels of debt that further monetary policy accommodation can adversely impact?
Well, the position I've had for quite some time is, yes, debt burdens in the households are considerably larger than they used to be. On all the evidence available at this point, households are managing that debt quite well. The delinquency rates, as you would call them here in the US, are quite low. So there's no material evidence of distress there. So they're handling the debt well, which isn't to say that you would be one will be comfortable with a big rise in the debt burden from here. I think were we to see that, I would feel uncomfortable about that. And this is the tension to which I was alluding in the talk, you know, where we've got very accommodative monetary policy. Part of how monetary policy works is it induces borrowing. And we have a modest rate of credit growth right now. We want to do what we can to help the economy with the adjustment, but we don't really want to try to buy just a short-run burst of growth at the cost of a much greater vulnerability in the future. That would not be a trade-off that we'll be wise to make, in my opinion. So what we're trying to do is strike the right balance between the need to help the economy adjust, to help support demand, but not get ourselves into too much trouble with future debt.
Glenda Corpra from the Australian newspaper. You've been fairly frank in the past year or so about the exchange rate, and it has come down a long way from about 95 to, I think it's probably about 76 at the moment. Mm. How much further can it go? If obviously it does affect, it's affected by the terms of trade. If you assume perhaps current levels of terms of trade, are you saying that the A dollar has got further to fall? And then I suppose if the terms of trade becomes lower, could it get into the 60s?
You're inviting me to pick a number, Glenda, which I have chanced my arm a couple of times in the past year and gotten away with it. I'm not sure I should try to keep repeating that trick, but I suspect further adjustment lies ahead. It is conditional on how low you think terms of trade goes, and obviously on all manner of other things that affects the currency. But I'll be a bit surprised, actually, if it doesn't go down some more yet.
Thank you.
Is that suitably enigmatic?
Hi, Michael Purcell with Citigroup. Your speech seems to imply that there's diminishing benefits of cutting rates further, yet the RBA still has an easing bias and still signaled a willingness to cut rates further if needed. Could you please talk a little bit more about the benefits of lower interest rates, and how much more room do you think you have to manoeuvre with it still being effective?
I think policy is still effective, but we haven't reached a council of despair position where we think it's completely useless to lower rates. But I think it has to be put on the table that to the extent that part of the way it works is by saying to people, please borrow against future income and spend today, but they've already done that and future income's lower and debt's already high, you have to think that the potential of that channel's a bit more limited than it used to be. That's what we're saying. Some people would argue that just means you should do more. Well, I'm not sure that I'd agree with that, but regardless of where you come out there, it's part of the landscape. It doesn't mean policy has no effect, but it's one of the limitations that I think we have to accept. There's a tendency for people to say, well, things are still not quite strong enough, just keep cutting. And I think you have to ask a few more questions than that and think about the channels through which it will be effective as you make your decision. So we've put on the table the possibility that through that particular channel, which isn't the only one, but it is one of the channels, the effect might be less than it used to be. The evidence at this point, if you tried to test this econometrically, you won't be able to tell. As usual with statistical tests, by the time they can tell you, it's way too late to kind of inform policy. But my suspicion is that people are less inclined today to rush out and borrow more money and go and spend with a 25-point rate cut than they might once have been, and that's a feature of the landscape we have to accept.
Warren.
Warren Hogan from ANZ Bank. Just on the monetary policy flexibility theme, you talked about some global risks out there, and I thought you raised a really interesting point on the earnings yield issue. But for you and the board at the Reserve Bank, how important is the concept of, for lack of a better word, keeping your powder dry, keeping some ammunition in reserve, just in case something goes horribly wrong in the broader global economy?
Well, it's a difficult one. It's difficult to know what one should make of the idea because one argument that we sometimes hear, though I don't think it gets a great deal of currency at the board, but the idea, well, don't cut so that you can cut when something really bad happens. The problem with that argument is that if it's appropriate to reduce rates because that will help the economy, you really should use that ammunition. There's no point waiting till it's not useful and then trying to use it. So I'm personally not that attracted to that argument purely as, well, let's just not do anything in case we have to do something later. I think it's better to do what's appropriate at the time. The more difficult thing is to work out what's appropriate at any one time.
Should I just talk? We'll just let the room hear your question. It'd be great. Okay. Thank you.
Craig Chapman from Sidley. So I want to turn you to your comments on growth. Can you give us a sense, because obviously that seems to be the biggest issue, particularly with China slowing down. What are you looking? What areas are you seeing or looking for growth in?
In China?
Well, for, I guess that would benefit Australia, for example.
Well, the growth picture that I spoke to from the IMF is pretty close to the one that we hold internally. We watch China as closely as anybody, of course, and that's a source of uncertainty inevitably. I still remain probably in the somewhat more optimistic camp than some, because I don't think it will all crash in a heap. But the truth is that the adjustment they're making in terms of the property sector, the financial excesses, etc., and the whole transition towards domestic-led growth and away from export-led growth, this is a pretty big transition. You know, it's no trivial task. They're well equipped to make it, but this is a big thing they're attempting. So it's a work in progress, and inevitably we can't be sure how that will turn out. For us, I think a more dynamic US is important, and that's not really because of the size of the trade relationship. There are a number of export markets bigger than the US in our trade. But I think the sense of optimism, animal spirits to use that term, that comes when American business feels good, feels in a mood to expand, I think a lot of Australian business people get that connection. They're still very informed and connected about what happens here, and that will help us independently of any trade link, I think. So I think that's very important, and hopefully that will continue. And then if the Europeans can manage the odd problem they have, that would also be helpful, but that's also a work in progress. About as much as we could say there.
I think we've got time for a couple more. One down the back.
Thank you. Hello, Governor Stevens. Good afternoon. My name is Trina Blair from InLogic. Quick question about the Murray Review, which was announced late last year. Could you share your thoughts on that review and any areas that you're particularly focused on as a result of that review?
I suppose the first thing to say, I thought the panel did a very good job, the review panel, in grappling with the various issues. And the first thing to say about their main findings is they found that there's not a huge amount wrong in the core of the system. You know, that the system did well through a pretty big test globally. That said, they have a number of areas of further improvement that can be identified. I think they've put their finger on some of the quite important ones. Some of those are in the retirement income space, and that's not my field, so I won't comment on them, but I think it was appropriate that there be a focus in that area. In the banking system, they are in favour of stronger capital standards, unquestionable strength, and you can see why, I think, that the tendency is to go that way. And these are the sorts of things that we will now have to grapple with. It's not a bad position to be in, to have had a system that came through the crisis very well. I think the lowest rate of return in any of our major banks was 10% return on shareholders' funds in the worst year. That's plus 10, not minus 100 or something like happened in some other places. They were able to raise capital in the heat of the crisis. So that's good. So we're coming from a position where things went well, but how can they be stronger? And how can we avoid any sense of complacency, which I think is something we do need to be careful to do. So I think the inquiry is timely, and its conclusions will repay careful thought. And I'm giving a talk on that set of topics next week or two. So I'll have a bit more to say maybe then, or maybe not. I haven't read the draft yet, but. If I have something to say, that'll be when.
One more.
I've been Plant Family Office. It seems to me there's a lag problem between yourself and the banking regulator in Australia, in that they partially contributed to the burst in the Sydney housing prices by allowing investor loans to skyrocket amongst the second-tier banks before capping them at 10% year on year. And secondly, there is now evidence of a significant breakout of interest-only lending on mortgages amongst virtually all of the banks. What's your comment in terms of the misalignment that appears to have been emerging in comparison with what you're trying to do on the economy?
Oh, look, I don't think I'd agree there's been a misalignment. We talk to APRA all the time. The question of housing lending has been something we've been talking about for the past year or so. It was when investor lending got to about 10% growth, that was the point at which I felt, yeah, we really should have a sort of a step here of a regulatory nature. There's bound to be some entities are growing more than 10, some will be less. That's a matter of their individual business models and choices and the risks associated with it, which would be an issue for APRA at a micro level to have a watch over, and I have no role in that myself. But as an economy or a macroeconomic phenomenon, I mean, and it wasn't until investor credit growth got to the high single digits or around 10 that I personally felt there was a strong case now to actually have a regulatory step. I mean, after all, we've got overall housing credit growth of 7 or something like that. You can't really get on the soapbox about that. Yes, you could go to an individual institution who might be at some much bigger number if you're APRA and say, let's have a look at what you're doing. But The extent to which they do that one-on-one, I don't really know. I don't have visibility over, and it's not my business. But at an overall level, you can't write home much about that pace of growth. But once we're at 10 for investors and they're half of approvals in Sydney, I felt, yep, something should not only be said, and we stepped up our rhetoric, which had been gradually increasing, and we worked with APRA on some measures. They've had their eye on interest only and some other features of lending standards for quite some time, and have been engaged in conversation with the banks about that. So I think it's an appropriately measured step. As I said earlier, credit conditions are not the only thing driving housing prices in Sydney. They're one thing, but not the only thing. Obviously, for example, the same credit conditions are in place across the country, but not all housing prices are doing what Sydney's doing. So that tells you it's more than just credit conditions. Nonetheless, it is important to have appropriately calibrated steps in response to these trends, and I think we've got that in place at present. If more is needed, more will be done. Whether more is needed yet isn't actually clear. It's a bit soon to know what the effect of the measures already taken have been just yet.
Thank you, Governor Stevens. I was just going to invite Francis Cassidy, the President of the American-Australian Association, up to make closing remarks.
Well, it's hard to know what to say after that, Glenn, other than to thank everybody for coming. Thank you, Glenn, for again coming and addressing us and giving us your time. We appreciate it very much. I want to thank all the board members and the association that are here. There's so many, we could almost have a meeting. I think we've got a quorum. But anyway, thank you all for coming. Thank you, Goldman Sachs, and hope we will see you shortly in perhaps another year or so. Thank you very much, everybody.